Good afternoon. You're listening to Ken Hudnall. This is the Ken Hudnall Show. Coming to you from our studios right here in exciting El Paso, Texas. Gateway to the Old West and the most haunted city in the country. The show tonight is unusual in that it's pre-recorded. There seems to be issues with the connection to the organization that puts my show out. So I pre-recorded a show just so I can make sure that I can stay in contact with listeners. Now, we've been talking about secrets of the dead. And last night, I started talking about the fact that even though history books don't report it, drug use was quite widespread during World War II. It's an urban legend with a grain of truth. Caffeine in the form of coffee was so critical to the G.I. Joe's ability to stay alert and focused during battle that when they came home, they referred to coffee as a cup of Joe. And later on, American soldiers would turn to even more powerful stimulant to help the Allies' war efforts against Hitler. Amphetamines. Now, the practice of using the powerful drugs didn't begin with the Allies, though. German pilots would often man 12-hour round-trip missions to drop bombs on enemy territory. Adrenaline would keep the pilots going during the actual operation, but there'd be an immediate wave of exhaustion that would follow when the pilots would struggle to stay awake for the return voyage to their home base. Well, a drug known as Pervitin, called a super drug that would supercharge its users, came into vogue. Its effects were to pump soldiers full of energy without fear of the need of rest or downtime. In fact, the drugs gave the Germans a huge advantage, allowing not just for resilience of the pilots, but it was also used by ground troops who could sometimes travel on foot for more than 20 miles a day. It would also allow soldiers to do so for several days in a row. Of course, Churchill was advised he should consider introducing a similar experimental drug to the British troops. He was a little reticent about doing it, and until recently it wasn't proven that the Allied forces were prescribing these type of drugs to the soldiers. But a document from a military medical officer who served in North Africa proved that orders for Benzedrine came from the top, the very top. Troops that were involved in the opening stages of the Battle of Alamein were given Benzedrine, according to historian James Holland, and were given it not just to keep them going, not just to keep them awake, but to also give them resolve, to give them confidence, to boost morale, I guess you could say. And late in 1942, Benzedrine was introduced to American troops as well. The use of Sherman tanks had given the British a victory at the Second Battle of El Alamein, and they were to keep the momentum against the Axis powers going. So Dwight Eisenhower, the commanding general, ordered 500,000 Benzedrine tablets to be given to American GIs. Now, there were downsides to the armed forces' use of these serious drugs. Pervitin and Benzedrine could keep soldiers awake for days at a time. It also sometimes left them with the worry they might never be able to sleep again. Military leaders also hoped Benzedrine would boost morale and protect troops mentally from the horrors of war that caused shell shock. Today, we call that PTSD. As many as 1 in 3 frontline soldiers will be incapacitated by what they experienced in combat. The fix, though, would only be temporary. Shell shock or PTSD would leave some soldiers seeking the drugs once the war was over. To deal with both the PTSD and their newly formed addictions to the drugs that were supposed to help them. Now, Benzedrine was also in use by the general population in the U.S., where passengers could actually order it in inhalers from the menu on commercial air flights. What was now seen as America's first prescription drug epidemic, millions of citizens were abusing what were called bennies that were marketed to consumers as diet pills and mood uppers. Still, for the militaries of the warring powers, the use of pharmacological warfare was key in battling each other with the increasingly sophisticated and devastating technological advances, like the Sherman tank and armor-piercing anti-tank guns. For us in the 21st century, drugs are bad, historian James Holland said. But if you look at it in the light of World War II, a lot was being expected of the young men of the major combatant nations, and it is, is it any wonder in this life and death struggle for the future of the world that people are going to be looking at drugs that can keep folks awake, that can keep morale improved, that can actually, hopefully, give them an advantage over the enemy. Now, there's a lot of things that took place in World War II that were little known to history. In fact, at the height of World War II, a little known conflict took place in the remote jungles of Borneo that actually created a team of unlikely allies. Now, high above the clouds, the formation of American B-52 Liberators flew above a tropical island on a routine mission to bomb Japanese ships in the Pacific. The country below them, though, was a mystery to almost all of them. Though sparsely populated and covered in dense mountainous jungle, Borneo had oil that made it an important battleground. The unlikely allies in this battle, a crew of stranded American airmen hiding from the Japanese, indigenous tribes who still fought with blowpipes and machetes, and one eccentric British major. All were hell-bent on taking jungle warfare to the enemies. After their sneak attack on Pearl Harbor, December 7, 1941, the Japanese military swiftly captured territories across Southeast Asia. By November 1944, however, the tide had turned. Japan was losing its grip on the region, and the U.S. were regularly bombing oil tankers coming to and fro from in and out of Borneo. In one particular bombing run in November of 1944, the Americans were surprised by heavier than expected anti-aircraft fire. One of the planes was hit and went down in Borneo's jungle interior, scattering the airmen across the jungle. And, unfortunately, not all of them survived. Dan Illerich and Phil Corin landed into the territory of the so-called Wild Men of Borneo. The outside world called the men Dayaks, but they were actually a group of more than 200 different tribes, many with fierce reputations. When the plane crashed, the Dayaks went to investigate. Illerich remembers meeting the Dayaks for the first time. We were sitting on the sand when the Dayaks got brave enough to come toward us. All of a sudden, they started hollering, "Yusha! Yusha! USA!" The airmen learned that American missionaries had visited these jungles in the 1930s. Japanese troops rounded up the missionaries and murdered them, including wives and babies. And this action bred a deep hatred for the Japanese among the Dayaks. Americans were soon reunited with two other members of their crew. They also met William Makahanap, the official in charge of this region for Japan. Makahanap had no choice but to inform the Japanese about the aircraft, but he and his wife felt a religious responsibility to keep the airmen safe. The four Americans remained hidden for the next 6 weeks. Their injuries began to heal, but malnutrition was taking its toll. By January, each man had lost close to 30 pounds. When a Japanese patrol began looking for the airmen, the Dayaks decided it was time to fight back against their occupiers. But they weren't just executing the Japanese. With Makahanap's tacit approval, the warriors resurrected the ancient ritual of headhunting. Now, the Dayaks were thrilled to have resumed their former custom. Headhunting had been practiced in Borneo for years because the island's colonial rulers, the British and the Dutch, had outlawed it at the turn of the century. Now, the ban hadn't stopped many Dayaks from missing the practice, which had been an intrinsic part of their culture for hundreds of years. The headhunting went hand in hand with special ceremonies in the longhouses and had more to do with ritual than war. After being removed from slain opponents, the Japanese heads were washed and dried before being smoked over the longhouse fire. According to Dayak beliefs, these were protective measures to ensure that no misfortune came to the longhouse. Now, the Japanese were wiped out by the actions of the Dayaks, but after 2 months in the jungle, the Americans had begun to suffer from tropical diseases and were losing hope. Luckily, the help was on its way in the form of an eccentric British anthropologist. By the fall of 1944, the Allies were recapturing territories like Borneo from the Japanese. British plans call for the establishment of a Dayak guerrilla army to ambush the Japanese. And to lead this unusual force, the British selected Tom Harrison, who had knowledge of the Dayaks, to parachute with a team of commandos into Borneo's interior. Well, once word reached the Americans, they quickly set up a group to set out on a week-long trek to join Harrison and his guerrilla army. After signaling to the U.S. Army their missing airmen were alive, Harrison got to work. He ignored orders to wait for the main invasion of Borneo and instead ordered his guerrillas to attack the Japanese at any point in time they had the opportunity. The Dayaks were encouraged to arm their blowpipes with poison darts when targeting the Japanese. Harrison said later, "I don't know if we were breaking any of the rules of war, and frankly, we didn't care." It wasn't long before Harrison realized that, like a hunt-up earlier, that he could unite the tribes against the Japanese by encouraging headhunting. He even supported the practice with a bounty. So much for each Japanese head. In May of 1945, the Allied attack on Borneo finally arrived. But before the Americans could be rescued, Harrison needed to construct an airstrip. In less than 2 weeks, Harrison and 1,000 Dayak volunteers constructed a 300-foot-long runway entirely of bamboo. June 10th, the first of the American airmen was flown out. Harrison decorated the airstrip with an array of national flags and a Japanese head. Less than 2 months later, a conflict fought with blowpipes and machetes was dramatically halted by the atomic bomb and the end of the war. Now, Harrison would leave Borneo within a year. During his time there, more than 1,000 Japanese soldiers met their end. It was a small but important Allied victory that wouldn't have been possible without the bravery of his committed tribal army. And of course, you have to ask yourself, what happened to the Dayaks after the end of the war? You know, there are many little-known incidents that have led to much bigger outcomes. For example, medieval records and disturbing archaeological finds shed light on shocking real-life vampire rituals, dating from hundreds of years before the publication of Bram Stoker's Dracula. In modern popular culture, the vampire is a creature that's alluring and terrifying in equal measure, using charm and charisma perfected over centuries of immortality to lure unsuspecting victims to their gruesome fates. But in the past, people didn't see vampires as fictional characters. They really believed they existed. Now, medievalologists and rare archaeological finds reveal clues to a horror story far more visceral and frightening than any fiction a writer could create. More than 500 years before a count from Transylvania began stalking the literary imagination of the Victorian era, a 12th century English abbot wrote The Life and Miracles of St. Maduina, one of several medieval manuscripts recounting events that took place nearly 1,000 years ago. Folk tales that tell ghastly stories of the walking dead. One section describes two peasants who died and were buried, but came back to terrorize villagers. They appeared at evening, carrying on their shoulders the wooden coffins in which they had been buried. The whole following night, they walked through the paths and fields of the village. To the medieval Britons, the afterlife was important as the earthly one. They believed that a proper burial gave them a greater chance of joining the ranks of those entering the bliss of heaven on Judgment Day. So a burial that didn't conform to Christian standards was something they avoided at all cost. But to protect the living from the undead, Anglo-Saxons resorted to all sorts of unusual burial rituals. Archaeologist and Anglo-Saxon burial expert Andrew Reynolds has uncovered another deviant burials all over England. We find corpses in some cases with the heads removed, in other cases with the hands or maybe the feet chopped off, he said. In other examples, we find people buried face down, in some cases with large rocks or stones piled over the corpse. And in the more extreme cases, we find bodies have been staked down to the ground. Frightened villagers would actually do literally anything to keep the dead firmly in their graves. Now, this bizarre behavior isn't limited to the distant past. In 2004, at a remote town in Romania, a group of villagers performed a vampire-slaying ritual on a recently buried corpse after a local woman began to complain of a mysterious illness. She claimed the decaying body of her uncle, who died 3 months before, was visiting her during the night and drinking blood from her heart. Well, the villagers understood this was the work of a vampire, and they knew just what to do about it. 6 men from the village went to the man's grave, chiseled open the tomb, and removed the body. They found the man's mouth stained with blood and his stomach swollen, so they cut open his chest, impaled his heart, and buried it at a village crossroads. Then they made a potion from the ashes of his heart and gave it to the woman to drink. According to the villagers, this finally put the troubled soul of the uncle to rest and cured the woman of her problems. Now, to understand the deep roots of vampire legends and rituals like these, researchers look at the folklore of the medieval era. The heart of all vampire lore is the terror of sickness and pestilence. Anglo-Saxons faced a world of scientific ignorance with no understanding of germs or contagion and no rational explanation why illnesses struck. And if death were the great unknown, then disease would be the first step to death. Now, it's hard to imagine just how terrifying the arrival of disease must have been for a medieval community. Blaming the dead was as logical as any other possibility. The St. Wodwina manuscript offers similar anecdotes of the living dealing with the undead. They cut off the men's heads and placed them in graves between their legs, tore out the hearts of their corpses and covered the bodies with earth again. They brought the hearts to the place called Dode Crossifora and buried them there from morning until evening. In times of plague, gravediggers, unable to keep up with the scale of the losses, dug huge pits for the dead, returning daily to deposit more bodies. As a result, they saw corpses in an advanced state of decomposition with bloated stomachs and what appeared to be blood-stained shrouds. To the 16th century mind, this was a clear sign that a vampire was at work. Today, science can explain these phenomena. Working at the University of Huddersfield in England, Dr. Anna Williams is an expert on what happens to a body post-mortem. Using pig corpses, she demonstrated some of the changes the villagers observed and attributed to vampirism are actually signs of natural decomposition. Bacteria and insects breaking down the body's tissues. Now, even though medieval Anglo-Saxons didn't have this scientific knowledge, their beliefs in vampires seemed to fade by about 1200 AD. And the early vampire rituals and legends remained largely unknown and unacknowledged until recently. Bram Stoker undertook meticulous research as he shaped his infamous character, Count Dracula. His great-grandnephew, Dracula Stoker, who has a set of notes in Stoker's own hand, reveals the fictional count wasn't simply a product of Bram Stoker's imagination. He knew how to put together, like a master chef, this vampire, taking existing folklore and putting it together to create this ultimate horrifying creature. The success of Dracula and its successors eventually obscured the old vampire folktales that inspired it. And once Dracula moved to stage and film, the image of the vampire changed again, becoming more sophisticated, moving even further away from its grisly real-life roots. But perhaps modern humans haven't really moved on from their medieval ancestors. Today's modern vampire obsession may exist because it still resonates with humanity's deepest primal fears. Which might be why, in one form or another, vampires have a habit of coming back. Through fiction, we can look into the last great unknown, death itself. Now, I want to take this moment to state once again, this is a pre-recorded show. There won't be any calls taken tonight. We'll be back Monday, hopefully live and able to take calls. Now, from vampires, let's turn to one of the great wonders of the world that may or may not have existed, Babylon's Hanging Gardens. In the 3,000 years since they were said to have been built, no one has found a single trace of the spectacular gardens of Babylon. But Oxford University's Dr. Stephanie Daly has a theory. Everybody's been looking in the wrong place. Now, the exact location of the Hanging Gardens, one of the seven ancient wonders of the world, remains one of the last great archaeological mysteries. Little evidence exists comes from a few accounts written hundreds of years after the gardens were built by people who actually never saw them, but merely heard about them. Yet, despite dozens of excavations in Babylon and investigations into the time of Nebuchadnezzar, no one has ever found archaeological evidence of a garden. And many scholars question whether the garden existed at all. According to Dr. Daly, it began to look as if we simply had the wrong place. Either the whole legend was a complete fiction or the gardens were somewhere else. Which makes sense, because if you're looking for something that you've misplaced, it's always in the last place you look. The same may be true about the Hanging Gardens. Now, Dr. Daly is a codebreaker, one of a handful of people in the world who can read ancient cuneiform text, script that's extremely obscure, and it's not alphabetic. It's got hundreds of signs, and every sign has several different possible readings, she explained. Now, her investigation into the location of the Hanging Gardens began when she studied the cuneiform scripts on a prism located at the British Museum. The prism described the life of a king named Sennacherib, who lived 100 years before Nebuchadnezzar and 700 years before Christ. He reigned over an empire that stretched from southern Turkey to modern-day Israel. Translations from the prism described the palace Sennacherib had built, including an expansive garden alongside the palace. Now, the writings suggest he built an extravagant garden which he had filled with exotic fruit trees and plants from across his empire. Another clue came in the form of a drawing in a notebook dating from the 1850s, a golden age of archaeological discovery. That's when it was a hobby set aside for the wealthy. Now, this drawing is an exact representation of a stone wall carving from Sennacherib's palace, showing a great garden with an unusual pillared walkway with layers of roofing and plant life. Now, Sennacherib and other great Assyrian kings lined their palace walls with bas-reliefs, huge carvings that describe the world around them. One such panel, known as the Garden Relief, is also located at the British Museum and shows Sennacherib's palace complex and a garden, with trees hanging in the air on terraces and plants suspended on arches. The prism and relief both placed the garden in Sennacherib's capital, and Sennacherib's capital was nowhere near Babylon. It was at Nineveh, more than 250 miles to the north. Could that arid country truly be the location of a lavish garden? I mean, let's face it, how did Sennacherib get water to the garden? Well, the answer lies in the Jerwan Aqueduct, a vast ancient canal network that controlled the flow of runoff from the distant Zagros Mountains that border Iran across the plains of northern Iraq into the city. This canal system, built hundreds of years before the Roman Empire existed, was a staggering achievement and one of the earliest known aqueducts in history. Predating by at least 500 years any Roman buildings. That wasn't Sennacherib's only achievement. He also conveyed water to the upper tiers of his garden, where trees and greenery grew using inspiration drawn from the trunk of a date palm. The spiral pattern around this tree's trunk resembled the shape of an Archimedes screw, the kind of screw used for drawing water uphill. It's named after the Greek who's believed to have invented it. But it's interesting to note that Sennacherib was using it 400 years before Archimedes was born. Which just goes to show that there's nothing new in the world. All clues point to Nineveh. However, to conclusively prove Dr. Daly's theory, she had to obtain access to the archaeological site, located near Mosul in modern-day Iraq. It was an impossible task. The archaeology site is effectively closed to Westerners. And despite sending in local filmmakers, Dr. Daly was unable to visit herself. It was simply too dangerous. During her visit to Mosul in 2013, a car bomb exploded at a book market and 47 people were killed or injured. On average, 100 people lose their lives every month. Today, the palace is under control of Iraq's Department of Antiquities and Heritage, and Nineveh is on the Global Heritage Fund list of sites in danger of irreparable destruction and loss. Any detailed archaeological study of this site, any confirmation of the true location of the Hanging Gardens, will remain impossible as long as that area remains politically unstable. And since outsiders continue to fund both sides in this internecine warfare, it shows no signs of calming down anytime soon. From the Hanging Gardens, let's turn to another hard-to-find location. Atlantis. Now, scientists investigate whether a massive tsunami or a volcano destroyed the ancient Minoan Empire and whether that society inspired the legends of a fabled land that disappeared beneath the sea. 5,000 years ago, the Minoan people flourished on the island of Crete. And at the height of their power, their culture vanished from the pages of history literally overnight. Its disappearance was one of the ancient world's greatest mysteries until the team of scientists unearthed startling new evidence about what may have destroyed the Minoans and gave birth to the myth of Atlantis. Now, centuries before the Greeks built the Parthenon, the Minoan Empire's vast reach and influence rivaled that of the ancient Egyptians. Archaeologists have identified settlements throughout Crete, the Aegean Islands, and parts of mainland Turkey. The Minoans were the first Europeans to use writing and the first to build paved roads. And they were masters of the sea, shipping to modern-day Spain and Mesopotamia. Along with beautiful buildings, artwork, and architecture, this sophisticated Bronze Age civilization cultivated a dark side. Cannibalism. In Gnosis, the Minoan capital, archaeologists found human bones with marks indicating they'd been butchered for meat, perhaps hinting at a grisly reality beneath the man-eating minotaur of Greek mythology. The Minoans left many tantalizing clues about their world, but nothing explained how such an advanced culture literally vanished. Archaeologist Sandy McGivelray, who has spent decades fascinated by Minoan art and architecture, believes a cataclysmic volcanic eruption could be the key to the Minoans' demise. But as he searched for the proof, he realized an eruption was only the beginning of the end for this civilization. Around 1600 BC, just 70 miles north of Gnosis, the volcano Thera violently erupted, blasting gas and rock and ash 25 miles into the stratosphere before its massive caldera collapsed into the sea. But the winds carried much of the ash away from Crete. So if the eruption didn't wipe out the Minoans, then what did? Dr. McGivelray discovered a crucial clue in a sediment layer at the excavation of Palacastro, a Minoan coastal town. Along with bits of bone, stone, pottery, plaster, and volcanic ash, this chaotically mixed sediment layer also contained tiny marine organisms normally found on the seafloor. Only one natural force could deposit these organisms so high on the land. A tsunami of incredible proportions. With help from Hendrik Bruins, a soil scientist from Ben-Gurion University and leading tsunami expert Kostas Sinolakis, Dr. McGivelray discovered more signs of tsunami damage further inland. Deposits of seashells and microscopic marine organisms as high as 102 feet above sea level. Carbon dating the samples from Palacastro confirmed the date of these deposits, 1600 BC. An exact match with the Theron eruption. Sinolakis created a computer model to simulate the disaster, and the results are horrifying. Moving at 10 to 20 miles per hour, the first wave was at least 30 miles wide and more than 65 feet high. Even more disturbing, the simulation showed a series of subsequent tsunamis, some only minutes apart, which would follow the catastrophic initial wave. Like a pebble dropping into a pond, when the caldera collapsed, it pushed multiple walls of water into the sea. Now, there are no written records of the Theron tsunamis, no figures for the death and destruction they caused. But by studying recent tsunamis, scientists can guess at their devastating impact. Dr. McGillivray estimates an 80% mortality rate in Crete as wave after cataclysmic wave obliterated all the major Minoan towns. In the decades that followed, invaders from the Greek mainland overwhelmed the weakened Minoans, conquering Crete as the last embers of the Minoan Empire flickered out, though it might live on in one of the Greeks' most famous myths. Thousands of years after the Minoan culture disappeared, Greek historian Plato wrote about Atlantis, a fabled city swallowed by the sea, strikingly reminiscent of an empire washed away by a tsunami. Now, we'll never know for sure if Minoan Crete is the true Atlantis, but at least we have an explanation for the downfall of Europe's first great civilization. And as with any disaster, the jackals come out to kill, steal, plunder, and such happened to Crete. Now, another famous legend that archaeologists thought was a myth was the fate of Troy. Now, archaeologists investigated potential locations for the ruins of Troy to determine where the legends in Homer's poem with the Iliad, including the great wooden horse, may be fact or fiction. Now, the legend of the Trojan Wars inspired storytelling in every arena of pop culture, from a big picture film starring Brad Pitt and an episode of the cartoon Phineas and Ferb, to a song by Eric Clapton and Cream, and a series of comic book adaptations by Marvel. But the main question, did Troy actually exist? And did that city fall after prolonged siege and trickery? Was there ever a giant wooden horse? It all depends on who you ask. Now, one probable fact, there exists in Turkey a site that most scholars believe to be the real Troy that Homer wrote about. German businessman and amateur archaeologist Heinrich Schliemann originally began excavation on the site called Hisarik in 1871. But many 19th century scholars refused to believe the site was Homer's Troy. The citadel Schliemann found just didn't seem big enough to match what Homer described, a large, fabulously wealthy city. Well, until the 1990s, that researchers found another area south of Schliemann's original discovery. That plain had once been enclosed and contained dozens, even hundreds of buildings, a large lower city. Today, some experts are convinced these areas perfectly fit Homer's description of Troy as a grand city with walls that couldn't be breached. Now, scholars sought to prove that this 50-acre site had provided the backdrop for Homer's epic. Generations of archaeologists have scoured these ruins trying to identify when these walls fell and what caused their collapse. Was the damage the result of time, or was it caused deliberately? As once believed, the cracks in the blocks that made up the defensive wall were evidence of an attack. The systematic destruction that followed after the Greeks slipped inside the city walls. But modern scholars, including archaeologist and historian Dr. Eric Klein, are less convinced. While the damage was extensive, there were tilted walls and things off kilter, but the damage was too extensive to have occurred in battle. Even Homer tells us the city was shaken by what he calls the wrath of the gods. What if instead of a literal wooden horse, Homer had been riding metaphorically? Having dismissed the possibility that the devastation was caused by an invading Greek army, Dr. Klein consulted with seismologists. In antiquity, they would have thought an earthquake might mean the gods were angry, according to Dr. Klein. Seismologists agreed that a series of quakes may have hit Troy in about 1300 BC. But Homer's war took place around 1180 BC, 100 years after the earthquake hit Troy. And the archaeological record demonstrates that Troy rebuilt and, more importantly, stockpiled food supplies when they did so. Other unearthed clues, such as records of the cities being burnt, arrowheads of Greek origin, and unburied skeletons, tell a brutal story. The written and archaeological evidence makes a clear case that the Trojan War and the sacking of the city isn't just myth, but historical fact. The city that seems to have been destroyed by an earthquake eventually recovered. It was rebuilt, and this city seems to have been destroyed by humans, according to Dr. Klein. But what about the most famous part of the story? Most scholars find the Trojan horse to be an unlikely tall tale. Even if, as in Homer's epic, there was no other way to get inside Troy's fortified walls, it seems an unlikely fabrication. And a frontal assault on the fortifications as excavated would have required men and resources far beyond what was available. The Trojans were ready for a long siege, and their walls were insurmountable. The idea that the Greeks found a radical way to end the siege, and not with brute force, but with guile, must be considered. To those who say the plan of using the Trojan horse was too simple and silly for the Trojans to believe, well, I would have to make the observation sometimes the simplest ideas are the best ideas. Well, from the bones that littered Troy, let's turn to the bones of Richard III, former King of England. It was an incredible archaeological discovery. In 2013, archaeologists at the University of Leicester announced that bones found in an English parking lot were those of the infamous King Richard III, buried more than 500 years ago. And it was just the start of an unbelievable journey back in time. William Shakespeare called him a hunchback, and scientists investigating Richard's bones quickly confirmed the diagnosis. The twisted spine was, in fact, scoliosis. Such an extreme medical condition and the physical limitations that go with it, could Richard still be the fearsome warrior and horseman history books can claim him to be? Well, in 1483, he seized the English throne. In August of 1485, he was brutally slain at Bosworth Field, the last English king to die in battle. Well, to get to the bottom of the mystery, scientists began their investigations by unlocking the clues hidden in Richard's bones, using atomic and microscopic analysis to learn about his health, his diet, his lifestyle. The skeleton's teeth suggested Richard ate a diet full of protein and essential minerals, indicating he was a fit young boy. The oxygen isotopes in his ribs signaled a big change in Richard's diet near the end of his life. The bones revealed that Richard was consuming a bottle of wine a day, every day, on top of all the British ale he drank. This copious consumption might well have impaired Richard's performance in battle. Drunks are not the best fighters. But his rich diet at the end of his life wouldn't have prevented Richard from fighting. The investigation then focused on his twisted back. Could he really wear armor, lead a heavy cavalry charge, and kill several men before dying at the hands of Henry Tudor's army, as written by Tudor's own historians? Remember, history is written by the victor, and such is the case here. Researchers searched for a living subject to test Richard's physical limitations. They stumbled upon Dominic Smee, a unique body double who volunteered his assistance to help provide a realistic picture of the king. A medieval enthusiast, his spine is curved in the same way as Richard's. With Smee's help, researchers could test the limitations Richard's spines would have in combat by outfitting Smee with medieval armor and training him to fight on horseback in full armor. A treadmill test on lung capacity revealed the first indication of a physical problem. Smee's chest tightened, and it was difficult to breathe after a run. Physiotherapist Claire Small, an expert on spinal pathologies, explained the issue. His ribs won't expand and contract because of the rotation of his ribs associated with the scoliosis. Now, Richard might have struggled when fighting for long periods, especially on foot. But Richard was most noted for his battle prowess on horseback, not on foot. Shakespeare's Richard III alludes to this after the monarch loses his horse mid-battle and says, "My kingdom for a horse." First step was to outfit Smee in armor, which raised new challenges. There's no English armor surviving from the 15th century, according to medievalist Toby Capwell. All the thousands of armors that were produced and worn during the War of the Roses, nothing that can be said to be the work of an English craftsman survives. A custom set of armor was designed by world-renowned armorer Pierre Lelilund for Smee to fit and flex like a glove, despite weighing nearly 70 pounds. According to Capwell, a good armor is a human exoskeleton. But Smee wasn't able to bear the weight of the armor without heavily customizing it. The nature of Richard's and Smee's scoliosis meant there was little room between his last rib and his hip bone. Bearing any weight at all there would be incredibly painful. The result was a custom chest and backplate, as figure-hugging and flexible as possible, something a monarch of England could easily have afforded to have made. Now, after outfitting Smee in armor, researchers mounted him on a horse. Now, when using a modern saddle, Smee struggled to control his mount. The curvature of his spine pushed his center of gravity toward one side. When he used a medieval saddle, the results were astonishing. The high, rigid back of the wooden medieval saddle added support to the part of the back where Smee and Richard most needed it. Rather than being a hindrance, medieval warfare equipment could actually help a person with scoliosis. The experiments with Smee suggested his curved spine wouldn't have stopped him from being a capable fighter and a talented horseman. After a year of research, the scientists at the university completed their study. Which is 3 months of training, Richard's body double, Smee, was able to fight effectively on horseback in medieval armor. At Bosworth Field, the curve in Richard III's spine may have caused pain, and his fitness level may have been compromised by the years of unhealthy living, but none of those conditions prohibited him from leading his men in battle. He could easily have led his cavalry at Bosworth Field. After making his final heroic charge, he lost his crown and his life. But as Smee helped to prove, King Richard, humpbacked though he was anything but disabled. Well, that does answer many historic questions. From King Richard III, let's turn to a study of a prehistoric boneyard. 10 million years after dinosaurs became extinct, two giant reptiles fought for supremacy in the prehistoric swamps of South America's Corion coal mine. So you have to ask yourself, did the 40-foot-long Titanoboa or the enormous Corion crocodile win the title of apex predator? There have long been stories of dinosaurs living in remote areas. The coelacanth, supposed to be extinct for 65 million years, was caught off the coast of Africa. Now, 65 million years ago, a giant meteor struck the Earth. Known as the KT extinction event, it destroyed an estimated 3/4 of all living species, including all the dinosaurs. Life on Earth changed forever. The land of giants was over. Or so it was thought. In Colombia, the Corion Mining Company operates one of the largest coal mines in the world. 2003, the mine reached the clitical layers laid down more than 10 million years after the extinction of the dinosaurs that roamed the Paleocene era. Paleontologist Jonathan Block realized the Corion mine could offer a glimpse into a lost world. And what his team found was stunning. That mine was rich in giant fossils, including a freshwater turtle the size of a family car. And most intriguing were the bite marks on its shell, indications this giant was prey to a much larger predator. What could eat something the size of a car? Well, that question was answered when a massive snake vertebra was discovered. Anacondas today are the largest snakes alive, but their vertebrae are dwarfed compared to that of the Coriolan monster. According to Dr. Jason Head, I was really worried that we were doing the math wrong. I simply had to accept the fact this animal was almost 50 feet long. Now, when I was in South America, we periodically ran over snakes with armored personnel carriers that didn't phase them. And the heads are in the bushes on one side of the road and their tail in the bushes on the other side. They were that long. Scientists determined that the giant snake to weigh more than a ton and to be five times bigger than anything alive today. They dubbed the python the Titanoboa. For years, scientists believed this massive reptile to be the apex predator of the Coriolan swamp. But it wasn't the only bone discovered in the swamp. 5 years later, another discovery by paleontologist Aldo Rincon would rewrite accepted history. Using a CT scan, Rincon determined this bone came from a giant crocodile and estimated its size to be almost 30 feet long and weighing 3 tons. It was the first definitive proof that giant crocodile survived the meteor strike that killed the dinosaur. Giant crocodile and colossal snake sharing the same ecosystem would inevitably fight. And paleontologists wondered which one would win. Titanoboa used the thermal equivalent of vision to stalk their prey, just as today's boas do. The super sense made it an expert at ambushing prey. And despite its size, it could move astonishingly fast. By examining minor snakes of various sizes, scientists were able to determine the giant snake could likely accelerate at roughly the speed of a gunshot when striking its prey, or an average 150 meters per second squared during their strikes. This incredible speed exerts a force 15 times greater than gravity. The speed of this giant snake was terrifying, but the giant crocodile was hardly slow. The secret behind that crocodile speed was its muscular tail that propelled it forward. Scientists believe the Coriolan croc could cover up to 40 feet per second, about its full body length, in approximately 0.2 seconds. Literally the blink of an eye. And the crocodile was equipped with its own unique tracking device. Thousands of tiny pressure sensors are sprinkled around its mouth and acted as built-in radar, which directed the croc to its target. Speed and stealth are just the beginning. These two predators use very different techniques to kill their prey. The Titanoboa exerted a crushing force, perhaps up to 250 pounds per square inch. That amount of force is, according to one expert, frankly not survivable. The crocodile's greatest weapon was its powerful jaws, the power of which was equal to that of a T-Rex, about 15,000 pounds of bite force. After studying these attack capabilities, scientists determined how the creatures killed. Wasn't a way to settle the debate, but rather how they ate. Lacking arms to grab or teeth for chewing, snakes are basically walking their body over the prey, in the words of Dr. Head. Even Titanoboa had limits as to what it could fit into its stomach. Crocodiles, though, don't need to swallow their prey whole. They rip it into pieces. And this predator had the size and force to outrank its rival. In the end, scientists believe the croc's size would have proved too much for Titanoboa. Coriolan has a new apex predator. Well, if they survive the extinction event, and 10 million years after the age of the dinosaurs, these two massive predators existed, what is to say they don't exist today, somewhere in the recesses of deepest, darkest jungle? Well, from there, let's turn to The Lost Diary of Dr. Livingston. Now, everyone has heard the expression, Dr. Livingston, I presume. Well, he left a diary, a journal, if you will. His name was David Livingston, and he was a British explorer. And private pages excised from the published journals of explorer Dr. Livingston share a different story about the British adventurer's association with the slave trade, of all things. He was a Scottish physician who became a popular British hero for his adventures as an explorer in Africa. He was also a Christian and an abolitionist whose years-long mission in Africa was likely motivated by his desire to end the slave trade on that continent. If he could find the source of the Nile River and spotlight more commercial trade routes, the populations throughout Africa would grow and they could be introduced to Christianity. And with that, he felt, they could bring about the end of the slave trade. Like so many others, he was actually at heart a fanatical missionary. Now, during his time in Africa, Livingston became the first European to view Victoria Falls, to open Central Africa to missionaries who came to help deliver education and to patent a pill, the Livingstone Rouser, a treatment for malaria. And for a guy who accomplished so much and had such good intentions of accomplishing so much more, he had some surprising connections to the slave trade. As his lost personal diary reveals, his explorations throughout Africa often meant he had to associate with some of the brutal slave traders to get by in desperate conditions. On more than one occasion, illness led him to rely on slave traders to carry him from one place to the next. Now, Livingstone, whose strongest argument for abolition came courtesy of a published personal diary account of the mass murder of hundreds of villagers by a vicious slave trader, it left some important details out of the public version of the diary. Now, his habit was to jot down notes and then later expand them to write journals about his explorations and what he experienced during his time. During a different time in 1871, when he was dealing with illness and a shortage of supplies, he spent 6 months in the slave trading village of Anyangwe, out of paper for journaling and low on ink for his fountain pen. He tore up newspaper sheets to write on and crushed berries to fill his pen. The notes he wrote on those pages turned into journals he shared with another explorer, Sir Henry Morton Stanley, the speaker of Dr. Livingstone, I presume, who later shared them with the public. The private notes, though, remained indecipherable, and after his death, they were passed down to members of his family. When researchers scanned copies of the personal notes via a high-tech process that brought to light the ink that had faded to illegibility across 140 years, they saw that the unedited copy revealed Livingstone's association with the slave trader leader who ordered the massacre. The notes also discussed his new servants, freed slaves who were dangerous men willing to commit murder and other nefarious deeds. The notes share a story where Livingstone ordered his servants to flog a man who double-crossed him in a deal to purchase a canoe. So after the mass killing in Dwangwe, that Livingstone began to realize he no longer wanted to pursue his goal of finding a source of the Nile if he meant continuing to work with the slave traders. According to Livingstone scholar Dr. Adrian Wisnicki, for Livingstone was a moment of both triumph and failure. Failure because he turns back from the quest he'd set his heart on, and triumph because when push comes to shove, he makes the right decision. Eventually, the British government did sign a treaty with the Sultan of Zanzibar that ended the East African commercial slave trade 1 month after Livingstone's death in 1873. Well, we got time for one last exploration into the secrets of the dead. Academics and archaeological experts have long discussed theories about the mysterious murders of immigrant railroad workers in 1832. Now, the freedom we enjoy to travel throughout the U.S., whether it be by plane, train, or automobile, is something we take for granted. But the luxury of railroad travel and the pivotal role that form of transportation played in building the country is a debt we owe to many immigrants who gave their lives for America's growth. In particular, part of the early construction of Pennsylvania railroads in 1832 is owed to a group of 57 Irish immigrants who died while laying line on a stretch of tracks about 30 miles outside of Philadelphia. The area is known as Duffy's Cut. The section is named after Philip Duffy, a contractor who hired the immigrants immediately upon their arrival in Philadelphia after an 8-week journey across the Atlantic Ocean. Sadly, the laborer's time in the land where they'd hoped to forge a new prosperous life after leaving their loved ones behind was shorter than the time it took to get them here. Within 6 weeks of the workers beginning the project, which would become the 59th mile of the Philadelphia to Pittsburgh line, they were dead, and it succumbed to an outbreak of cholera. Or so it was believed for more than 180 years. In 2002, Frank Watson and his twin brother Bill discovered a secret hidden in files kept by their recently deceased grandfather, Joseph Tripicon, the executive assistant to a man who later became president of the Pennsylvania Railroad. These files revealed the company had kept the deaths of the workers a secret, with one document specifically spelling it out. It's not desired to let it get out of the office, according to Frank. That sent the brothers, Frank, a reverend, and Bill, a professor, on a mission to find out why the deaths were such a hush-hush bit of the railroad's history. And what they found was absolutely shocking. Some of the immigrant workers hadn't died of disease. Most likely they'd been murdered. Additional documents in their grandfather's files pointed to an area along Duffy's Cut where the workers had been buried in a mass grave. Collaboration with other academics and archaeological experts led the Watson brothers to locate and excavate some of the burials. Examination of the remains they found suggested head injuries, bullet holes in skulls, and other trauma indicated that at least three of the male laborers and one woman were the victims of crime. But if they were murdered, why? The brothers and their fellow investigators came up with many theories. A local vigilante group made up of residents might have been responsible for violence against the workers who weren't welcome in the area because they were foreigners. Another theory suggests local residents may have sought to get rid of remaining workers after cholera deaths began as a way to stop the disease from spreading throughout the community. Whatever the motivation behind their deaths, the Watson brothers and their equally committed cohorts have ensured that at last the immigrant laborers will not be forgotten. The remains of several of the men and one woman that the Watson brother team located at Duffy's Cut were buried in 2012 at the Les Laurel Hill Cemetery near Philadelphia. The remains of another man, thought to be 18-year-old John Ruddy, were taken back to Ireland for burial. According to Frank, this is just one part of the telling of the building of our country, and it's an important part of the picture. 57 individuals will be remembered for future generations. As many as 50,000 died building the railroad from east to west. But the question becomes, why the murders? Well, we've come to the end of another show. We'll be back on Monday when I hope we'll be live once again. Until then, this is Ken Hudnall for the Ken Hudnall Show, saying have a truly great weekend.